direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. Sorry. I got very distracted because when I start a show, I like to turn off my phone, as one of our guests will know, because he was on a show recently and his phone rang. And I don't like my phone to ring in the middle of a show. It's almost as unprofessional as turning off the ringer in front of people live. Okay, it's off. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. I am, of course, your host, Billy Masters. Today, thank you, Monica, is Thursday, May 6th, 2020. I am still in Boston. And since I do have my phone here, I'm just curious. It looks really nice out. Oh, my God, 63 degrees. 2 days ago, it was in the 40s. So this is just madness. But, you know, why wouldn't it be a beautiful day out when I have a show? And, you know, why would I want to be outside walking when I could spend the time with you guys and my guests? You know, it's very fortuitous that today's show was planned because just yesterday came news of when certain Broadway shows are going to be opening. As you all know, Broadway has been shut down since last March, I think the 11th. I don't know. Michael will know, I'm sure. And, you know, first it was going to be for like a couple weeks, then it was a couple months, and now here we are over a year later, and still no shows. But even though shows can reopen, we will not expect really any, you know, real movement until the fall. Although Off-Broadway has been making some news with opening up. Anyway, before we get to today's show, let me just tell you, last week's show was so popular. So when I started doing this, which was when the pandemic started, the whole idea for the show was that it was interesting combinations of people. And what happened after maybe 70 shows was that I stopped getting very interested in the combinations. I kind of felt like, oh, I've already talked to everybody. And I got away from it and I started doing really long form interviews with individual peoples, which was fine, but really wasn't the show I wanted. And last week I got back to it. And this week we're going to have it as well. And next week we're returning. Last week's show was Bruce Valanche, Richard J. Alexander, and Johnny Beauchamp. And it was so interesting because we had three gay men of three, I guess if you throw me in, four different generations, or really three and a half. I'm like, I straddled the generations. And it was so interesting. And so next week, we're doing another panel discussion show just about general interest, pop culture, no agenda, and we'll see where it goes. But the numbers were amazing last week, so thank you all for tuning in. Please, if you're watching, because Kenny will yell at me if I don't say this. So, you know, like at the bottom there, if you're watching on YouTube, there's the little like icon of what this show is. So if you click on that, you can subscribe to our channel. But you also have to click the bell underneath. I don't know why, but I'm told that you have to press the bell. Press it, don't press it. I don't care. Anyway, okay. You know, it's very interesting that two very different books about Broadway have been released in the past month. Well, actually a few months now. My first guest is Michael Riedel. Michael Riedel, many of you probably know. I would love to say he's the Billy Masters of Broadway, but he was the Billy Masters of Broadway before Billy Masters existed. But he has written columns covering Broadway for years. He also was a co-host for years on Theater Talk, which is distributed through PBS channels around the country. He has his second book out right now. Now, let me look. I got the image of it. Okay, so this is his first book, which is called Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway. It is so good. And I was like, oh, you know, the first book was so good. How good can the second book be? Second book's even better. Second book is Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. And really, anybody who is a fan of Broadway, start with this book. because they're kind of chronological, and really the second one is a sequel. You can read it on its own, but you got to read this. This gives you like the history of everything that happened on Broadway before the 90s. The newer book goes the 90s through roughly September 11th, and a forward a little bit about what's going on in today's pandemic. And I am thrilled to welcome Michael Riedel to the show. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Billy. How are you? Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. I love these books. And what I love about them is that they're really a comprehensive history of, if you want to know what went on behind the scenes of Broadway, how we got to where we are, different phases of the history of the geographic area, it's all encompassing, but not in a, you know, reference book kind of way, like in a fun, breezy, conversational way that really captures your interest.
Yeah, well, the first book is really about my friendship over the years with a lot of the people who ran the Schubert Organization. And the Schubert Organization is the most powerful theater company in the world, really, because they own the real estate. And you may have the best play in the world, the best musical in the world, but if you don't have a theater to put it in, no one's ever going to go to see it. So right. The power is with the people who own the theaters. And so Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway, was about the Schuberts and Jimmy Niederlander, who also owned theaters, and their struggles really to keep Broadway together at a very, very perilous time for the business. I mean, it's been pretty tough this last year with the pandemic. But you go back to the late 60s, early 70s, you have a New York City that's going bankrupt. Times Square is very dangerous. It's the sleazy Times Square of Taxi Driver. Not the Disney Times Square that we know, right? Although, listen, I was on Times Square the other day. It's going back to the sleazy, seedy days. I can tell you that. Sliding back, there's a problem going on.
Makes me happy.
They got to solve that problem. But yeah. So the book was about how, and you got to remember back in the early 70s, Broadway theaters had no value, Billy. I mean, you know, Stephen Sondheim.
They were tearing them down.
Well, what do they say in Follies? You know, in a final burst of glory, this theater is going to be a parking lot, because yeah. They had more value in 1971, 72. They had more value as a parking lot. But the Schuberts, the Niederlanders, Michael Bennett with the Chorus Line, Joe Papp in the Public Theater, leading up to Andrew Lloyd Webber and Cameron Mackintosh with, you know, Cats, Phantom, Les Mis, they're the handful of people who stuck by Broadway and really saved it at a time when it could have gone totally out of business. So I ended that book the beginning of the 90s, when one of my main characters, Bernie Jacobs, who ran the Schubert Empire back mm-hmm. when he died. And then I really thought I was done writing about Broadway. I figured, I mean, I got one book in me, that's it. You know, it takes a lot of work to write a book. And I thought,
how long did the first book take to write?
Takes me four years to do a book. So it took
wow. Yeah. And, you know, let me just correct one thing you say, because while it does talk about your friendships, you also give history, not as extensive as what you lived through, but really what led up to those men really controlling Broadway.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's kind of fun to write about the original Schubert brothers who created
the empire. I didn't know any of that.
Well, they were three illiterate Jewish immigrants from Syracuse, New York. And, you know, the story, it's a great American story, really. Little Sam Schubert Theater, the Sam S. Schubert Theater, where a Chorus Line mm-hmm. played for many years, is named after Sam Schubert. Sam Schubert, when he was about 13 or 14 years old, he was selling newspapers in a very cold, wintry February day. And a guy who owned the theater in Syracuse took pity on this little kid, saw him outside there, you know, trying to sell his newspapers, said, you know, come on inside to matinee, get warm, watch the show. Within a week, Sam Schubert, 13, 14 years old, okay, can't read, illiterate, he's in the box office of the theater. Within 2 years, wow. He owns the theater. By the time he's 20, he owns four theaters in upstate New York. And then into his 20s, he comes into New York City and he begins to build the Schubert Empire. And at the height of his building of the empire, he brings his younger brothers in with him, mm-hmm. Lee and JJ. And they're in this titanic fight with the powers that be at the time, the Abe Erlanger, the name was, and he ran this, I can't remember the name of the thing now, but anyway, he ran this thing called the Syndicate, and they owned all the theaters, they controlled everything. And the little Schubert brothers, they're in there scrapping, trying to make a living, trying to carve out a little plot for themselves in New York City. And just as Sam Schubert is coming up, as he's rising, He's on a train going down to Pittsburgh, and the train collides with a munitions train. There's an explosion, and Sam is blown up. He lives a few hours after the train, and his legs, apparently he was burned from his neck down. His body was charred. And I found a description that a friend of his who was with him said that his legs were actually smoking. He was a piece of charcoal. And he dies, and his brothers, Lee and JJ, without Sam's leadership, they're totally bereft. And Abe Erlanger and the syndicate, they move in and they say, okay, we're going to buy you guys out. Your brother's dead. Without him, you got nothing. We're going to buy you guys out. And just as Lee and JJ are about to sign the contracts to give up the Schubert Theaters to their rivals, they say, you know, you had one deal with our brother who just died for a show, and we just want to keep that deal in place. And Erlanger said, I don't keep deals with dead men. And Lee and JJ, they left that meeting and they said, we're going to kill that bastard. And they did. And they went on this building spree and they built all of the theaters we know and love today. They built the Belasco. They built the Broadhurst. They built the Schubert. They built the St. James. And at the end of the Depression, Erlanger and the syndicate completely bankrupt and gone. And the Schubert brothers controlled everything.
You know, which actually brings up a question that I had, which is, were the Schuberts motivated by art or by commerce? Because it really seems like it was a way for them to really make it in the new world. And I wasn't sure, you know, there are a lot of people that do a lot, but they're passionate about the art. And there are other people who are passionate about business and making money.
I think Sam Schubert, the founder of the empire, he loved business, of course, and he loved money, but he also did like the artists. He liked the actors. Lee and JJ, they were business guys. They were basically real estate guys. And then, you know, when the company was taken over, as I show in my first book, Razzle Dazzle, Bernie Jacobs and Jerry Schoenfeld, they were the lawyers. They weren't artists.
Right.
They were the lawyers for the Schubert brothers. They were these guys that no one had ever heard of before. But the company was falling apart. Broadway was falling apart. The company by that point was being run by a drunk nephew of J.J. Schubert. I mean, the guy literally, he ran it from the second floor bar at Sardi's. He was drunk all day long trying to book theaters, and he was bombed. And Bernie and Jerry, these lawyers who knew nothing about the arts, they didn't know anything about how to talk to a Bob Fosse or a Michael Bennett or anyone like that. But they realized if we're going to survive, we got to knock this guy out, take over the company for ourselves, and keep this thing together before it falls apart. And they did. But in so doing that, Bernie and Jerry, they did learn about the arts. And the most important thing that they learned, and this was kind of key to their success in the 70s and then into the 80s and the 90s, they realized, look, we can't tell if the play's good or bad. We really can't. You know, what do we know? But we will back people who come up with the ideas for a show. And Bernie Jacobs thought this kid that he met who was choreographing and kind of secretly directing a musical called Coco with Katharine Hepburn. Bernie Jacobs is at the opening night of Coco, and he meets this young kid, and he says, I got to ask you something. You're directing this thing, right? And this kid says, yeah. And Bernie says, how do you control Katharine Hepburn? And this kid said, it's easy. If I want her to go right, I tell her to go left. And that kid was Michael Bennett. Wow. And Bernie Jacobs said, you know what? I like this kid. This kid's going to do something. And indeed, that kid did a chorus line. And the Schuberts put a chorus line open at the Public Theater, but they moved it to Broadway. They put it in the Schubert Theater. It ran 15 years, and it began, it was the cornerstone of the empire that the Schubert organization is today, a multi-billion dollar company that before the pandemic was just printing money. But it was because, you know, someone like Bernie recognized, you know, I can't create a chorus line. I don't even know what a chorus line is. Someone comes to you and says, we're going to do the show. It's all about the anonymous people who just dance behind the star and there's no star. Does that make sense to the show? No. But he believed in Michael Bennett. And Michael Bennett delivered a chorus line, and then he delivered Dreamgirls. And then sadly, as I show in Razzle Dazzle, you know, he died of AIDS at 44 years old.
You know, what I loved about Razzle Dazzle, because I came into really Broadway, became part of my life in the 80s. So I remember the whole Dreamgirls versus Nine situation, which, oh, that whole sequence in your book is my favorite in the first book, because you really show all the machinations that were going on behind the scenes and how art almost took a second seat to marketing, to power, to jockeying for position, and to winning Tonys.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, art went out the window when these guys wanted to win the Tony, because the Tony's still an important
survival.
Thing. But back then, back in the 1980s, to win the Tony meant 5, 6, 7 years extra life on your show, plus all of the productions that are going to go around the world. So a Tony Award back then for Best Musical is worth millions of dollars. And they were manipulating everything behind the scenes. And the Schuberts were very, very powerful then. They had Michael Bennett. They had a Chorus Line. They had Dreamgirls. And they wanted that Tony Award. Because Dreamgirls, you got to remember, was not the hit that a Chorus Line was.
Right.
They didn't show Dreamgirls, but it was what we call in the business a soft hit. And they could see the box office was not as strong as it was for a Chorus Line. And they knew that they needed the Tony Award. But they were up against, at the last minute, Tommy Tune comes in. His first show that he directs and choreographs, called Nine, wonderful show written by my good friend Maury Yeston, and also sadly Arthur Copit, who just died a couple of weeks ago.
And starring Anita Morris in that fabulous bodysuit.
Designed by William Ivy Long, absolutely.
That whole story was amazing too.
Well, I'll tell you, that story was, that's a great story in the book that William Ivy Long told me. He could not come up with that suit for her. He just couldn't get it. And one day she was very unhappy with all the costumes that William made for her. And one day she came in, she said, Oh, I have the mumps. And William is like, listen, I got nothing to lose. And he took out this bolt of material, which was this kind of see-through nylon-y black stuff. And he just started draping it over her. And suddenly the mumps went away. Checking herself out in the mirror and how sexy her rear end was and everything else. And by the end of that, William had come up with that famous cat suit that she wore. And I think I was talking to my friend Bruce Valanche, who was on your show last week, mm-hmm. Bruce, who was around then. Bruce said, you know, we all knew about Dreamgirls because it was a big hit at the time. We didn't know anything about Nine. I mean, it came in at the last possible minute. He said, but all of a sudden, you know, in the gay tom-toms, as they were going on, he said, you heard that there was this fiery redhead in this see-through black bodysuit. That's all you heard about Nine. And that was Anita Morris. And at the end of the day, Nine beat Dreamgirls. The Niederlanders beat the Schuberts for the Tony Award. And that's a story I tell in my book. And I'm pleased to say, I can't give you the name yet, but a very prominent writer and director has optioned my book to be made into a TV series. And that whole Nine and Dreamgirls saga is going to be very well told, I think, by this guy.
Well, you write in a very cinematic way that you really can visual. I mean, granted, you're writing about, I don't want to say a cinematic medium, but a theatrical medium that you can visualize. So I think it is ripe for one of those extended miniseries. So yeah. I think that's great. But I have two questions. First, just to look back, you talked about that winning a Tony could add years to a show's run on Broadway. When did that actually become important? Because my recollection of early Broadway is, you know, Cole Porter had a show on Broadway for a year, and then the next year he had another show. Like, things didn't run for years on end.
No, the Tony Awards, which began just as a nice little industry thing at the Waldorf Astoria, right? I mean, it was just, you know, Cole Porter and Julie Andrews and Rex Harrison and Richard Rodgers, you know, all hanging out at the Waldorf Astoria. That's all it was. When it became important was when Alexander Cohen took it over and put it on television. Then when it was broadcast on CBS for many years nationally, that suddenly became the best advertisement ever for Broadway. So you have, you have this industry that's basically for New Yorkers back in those days. Now suddenly you got 3 hours on a Sunday night on a major network. And America, back then you were getting 7, 8, 9 million people were watching the damn thing, right?
Wow.
7 or 8, 9 million people. If only 10% of those people buy tickets to a Broadway show, there's your audience for the next year.
But didn't Ed Sullivan have that power before then?
Ed Sullivan absolutely did. But remember, Ed Sullivan had faded by the time the Tony broadcast in the 70s.
But did he have the same power that the Tony broadcast did? I always thought that if Ed Sullivan had My Fair Lady on next week, the box office exploded.
Well, famously, Camelot was dying at the box office, and he put Julie Andrews and Richard Burton on from Camelot. And then the show ran 2 years and became a big hit. Absolutely. But you got to remember with Ed Sullivan, and I do think I show this in Razzle Dazzle. Ed Sullivan began as a Broadway columnist, and his best friend was Richard Rodgers.
True.
And when he first started his show, it was all about Broadway. But then the culture and taste changed. And if you look at the later Ed Sullivan shows, he's got to do Motown. He's got to do the Rolling Stones.
It's much more of a potpourri.
Exactly. And Broadway begins to take a back seat to what Ed Sullivan's doing. And I know from talking to, for the book, I interviewed one of Ed Sullivan's old producers. And he said, look, do you think Ed Sullivan cared about the Rolling Stones? He didn't know who they were. He thought they were these long-haired hippies. But we were under such pressure from CBS to get ratings, to get younger people. Right. They were like, you can't put this Broadway stuff on. Broadway's what grandma goes to. You know,
well, now in the second book, again, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, it opens with something that I had covered extensively because I was there. This is when I had started writing as well. So there were things that you wrote about that I had intimate knowledge of, and there were things you wrote about that I had never heard of at all. But it starts with the Sunset Boulevard debacle. And really sort of shows the rise and the fall of the whole idea of the concept musical, the British invasion, and really America trying to take back the roots of Broadway. And where is Broadway now? Is it somewhere in the middle? Because it seems like the Wild West all over again.
Yeah, no, there's certainly a lot more stuff going on Broadway. I mean, I opened Singular Sensation, which is the story of Broadway in the 1990s, leading up to September 11th, and how Broadway came back after what we thought was its existential crisis. Little did we know that the pandemic would be coming 10 years later or so. But I wanted to open with a dramatic way. And I thought Sunset Boulevard, although we did not know this at the time, but Sunset Boulevard was the last of those big British shows that dominated Broadway in the 80s. And you remember, everything had to be big. You had to have the falling chandelier, the flying helicopter, the barricades, the tire goes up to the heavy side layer. And in the case of Sunset Boulevard, Norma Desmond's
a house.
2 tons. I remember it flew. I can't tell you politely why a house flies. The only house I know that ever flew was in, The Wizard of Oz. Okay. And that was, but for some particular reason, Norma Desmond's house was flying. And I do remember, because I went to the opening on Broadway of Sunset Boulevard, and I remember thinking, man, this show, and Sunset Boulevard is not a bad show. It's a beautiful score.
No.
Lloyd Webber. I think, As If We Never Said Goodbye and With One Look are two great, great musical theater songs. But I do remember thinking, man, this show is heavy. For a show that's intimate, it's only about three people. Joe Gillis, Norma Desmond, and Max, the butler. Really, it's a triangle. And for a show, an intimate show, they have spent a ton of money. And I just remember thinking, there's a heaviness to this.
Yeah.
How much further can these kind of shows go? Are they getting just too lumbering, too heavy? And what we didn't know at the time, but what I try to show in the book, is that indeed things were changing. And Sunset Boulevard was not a hit.
It
never made any money. Anywhere it played, it never made any money. And the year that Andrew Lloyd Webber is winning the Tony Award for Sunset Boulevard, because there was no competition back then. I think the only show that it was up against was Smokey Joe's Cafe, which was the year that Andrew is accepting the Tony Award, he's still Andrew Lloyd Webber at the top of his game. There's this kid writing a show that we've never heard of before. We've never heard of this kid, never heard of the show. And the show he's writing is about what's happening in New York City right here, right now. Young people struggling, young artists struggling with drug addictions, fighting AIDS, dying of AIDS, trying to keep a foothold in a city that's being gentrified. And that show was Rent. And then here, as I show in the book, Andrew Lloyd Webber presents the Tony Award posthumously to Jonathan Larson, who wrote Rent, died right after the first dress rehearsal of Rent, and he never lived to see how his show completely changed everything. I mean, it was the end of the Andrew Lloyd Webber era. The English were gone. The expensive, big $14, $20 million shows, gone. Rent, it's about young people. It's contemporary.
And it's a non-musical. In its marketing.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, I show that in the book. I mean, the producers of Rent, Kevin McCollum, Jeffrey Seller, they were like, we've got this thing. It's a rock. It's got a rock score, but it's kind of operatic since it's based on La Boheme. But Jonathan, he also loves Stephen Sondheim, so he can write musical theater songs. But there's an influence of Billy Joel and Bruce Springsteen all there. They're like, what do we call this thing? Do we call it a rock opera? Do we call it an opera? Do we call it a musical? And they decided we're not going to call it anything but Rent. And we'll let the audience decide for themselves what they see it as. And it was a
which I found fascinating because Andrew Lloyd Webber had kind of gone the same trajectory with Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita being sort of rock and concert and, you know, in killing voices of legit singers, but opening new doors and somehow retreating from that more into standard book musicals.
Yeah, well, I mean, the great thing about Andrew is his mind ranges, his musical mind and his intellectual mind ranges all over the place. I mean, here's a guy, he wrote a rock musical about Jesus Christ Superstar, and he wrote one of the great romantic musicals of all time about this disfigured guy who, you know, drops a chandelier on people. I mean, he's a homicidal maniac, but he's romantic. So, yeah, that's right. I do remember Andrew telling me once, no, actually, you know who it was? It was Bono. So when I was talking to Bono about just before Spider-Man opened and I killed that show, but before I'd seen it and before I decided
to kill it, you don't need to see a show to kill it.
No.
Let's make that clear.
But I remember Bono telling me, I said, why are you bothering to write a Broadway musical? You know, you're one of the most successful rock singers and rock musicians of all time. Mm-hmm. And he said, I was at this dinner party with Andrew Lloyd Webber. And Andrew got up and he said, I want to thank Elton John and Bono and Mick Jagger. I want to thank all you rock and roll guys for leaving the field to Tim Rice and me with Jesus Christ Superstar and Evita because we never had any competition. We did pretty well. And Bono thought, you know, maybe he's onto something. Maybe I should try my hand at writing a rock musical. Sadly for Bono, it didn't work out that well. As we know, Spider-Man turned out to be the biggest flop in the history of Broadway, which will be covered in my third book when I get around to writing that one. Which will be the
I can't wait.
Well, that third book will be Destroy Broadway in the 2000s and How Broadway Comes Out of This Pandemic. And
well, you couldn't have written this. I mean, it's funny because in your book, let's show it again. Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, the foreword is actually written on sort of the opening days of the pandemic. Were you skiing in the Dolomites? Is that where you were?
Well, I'd finished the manuscript for the book, and you know the book ends on an upbeat note because
yes.
As horrible as September 11th was, Broadway bounced back very quickly, and New York bounced back very quickly. And I tell that story of how Broadway came back after September 11th. And I finished the manuscript, and I treated myself to a skiing vacation in Zermatt in Switzerland.
Oh, Zermatt.
And,
okay.
It's right on the border of Italy, and so one day it's a beautiful day. I go all the way to the top of the mountain. And you can, that day, it's the borders open. You can ski from Switzerland right into Italy, into Cervinia.
Oh, wow.
So I'm skiing down in Italy, having a great old time. I have a glass of wine at lunch. I take a picture of the wine glass with the Matterhorn in the background. I text it to my girlfriend and I said, happy trails. She said, where are you? I said, I'm in Italy. She said, do you have any idea what's going on? And I was like, no. I mean, I was, was it going to be Bernie Sanders or Joe Biden? That's what I was paying attention to.
Right. She
says, there's this thing called the coronavirus, and it's spiking in Italy. Get out of there. Three days later, they closed down the resort.
Everything.
Because.
Really?
So then I get back. Then I get back to New York. Thank God I was leaving 2 days later. Thank God I did. Because if I hadn't caught that plane out, I would still be.
You'd be stuck.
I would be, the Von Trapp family. I'd be going. I'd get out of there. In any case. I got back and I thought, oh my God, Broadway shut down. I've just written this book called Singular Sensation.
The Triumph.
Hello, I never intended to be ironic. So I called my editor and I said, my book is out of date. What do I do? And he said, no, look, your book's history. Your book is about the 90s. It's about a different time. Just write a foreword framing it that pandemic is here. We don't know what's going to happen. But this is about a time when Broadway was resilient again. And I do think if my books have any value whatsoever, they do show you how resilient Broadway is. Okay. It survives the Great Depression. It survives a lot of television and movies. It survives the collapse of New York City financially in the 70s. It survives, the Times Square turning into the seedy place. It survives AIDS, which we forget now. You know, talk about a pandemic. Broadway knows what a pandemic is. Okay. Broadway went through a pandemic that killed a lot of people on Broadway in the 80s and the 90s. But Broadway, and it also survived 9/11. Broadway is incredibly durable, incredibly resilient. It will survive. I don't know what it's going to look like. And I think it's going to be more of a challenge to come out of the pandemic even than it was to come out of 9/11, but it will be here. And in a year and 2 years, and, you know, when my next book is finally done in 80 years, we'll be talking about how Broadway came back after the pandemic that shut down a business it'll be a year and a half by the time Broadway is not opening until September, as you know. So it'll be a year and a half.
You just mentioned something, and this may be a personal question, and feel free not to answer it, but you said you got a call from a girlfriend. I've always assumed that you were some gay theater kid.
Well, if only. I have to get this word out. She's actually my fiance, because I proposed.
Oh, my God.
I proposed to her on New Year's Eve here in New York.
Wow, congratulations.
Yeah, we've been together 10 years, and I thought, look, we barreled through a pandemic. We should be able to get through, the fact that you have to live with me. Which is not rushing.
Well, see, there you go. We're breaking news, unless people already knew that, because apparently I didn't know it. But, you know, the other point is that the book, in a way, I was nostalgic reading it during the pandemic, because it did make me, you know, when I read it, I'm thinking to myself, oh, Broadway's gone and we're sitting here, we're all home. And it actually made me very hopeful, because it did make me think, wow, we've gotten through so much before. There's a wonderful sequence towards the end where you go to the first performance after September 11th of the producers with Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. And when people are singing God Bless America, led from the stage, that it's this teary moment of people coming together. And I thought that's almost a blueprint of what could come next. For us.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the difference between, of course, the terrorist attack and the pandemic is after September 11th, and I lived through it here in New York City. I saw the World Trade Center from my window down here in the West Village. I mean, I saw the second plane hit the tower. I saw both of the towers fall. But you wanted to be together. People wanted to be together. You know, I remember walking around the village that night, and everybody was out. People just were, sadly, some people were out, you know, looking for loved ones who never came home then.
God, yeah.
But people wanted to be together. The problem with the pandemic was you couldn't be together. We were told you can't.
And you don't want to be near anybody.
You can't go sit with 1,500 people. No. And right. You know, the challenge for Broadway is going to be, when you bring it back, a lot of my friends on Broadway, who are the producers, they believe, oh, there's this pent up demand. People are going to, they want to come together. They want to be back in live events again. And I don't know. I mean, I talk to a lot of my older friends who say, look, I'm vaccinated, but I don't know how comfortable I'm going to feel sitting with 1,500 people I don't know anything about. Now, right. And, you know, forget about the new strains we got coming. If you look at India, my God, I mean, every day there could be 12 new strains coming out of India. And how effective is the vaccine going to be against what's going on in India and Turkey and Brazil? So we are not out of the woods yet. And
we're talking about the fall, and we don't know what's going to happen next week.
We don't know. And, you know, I dare say to my friends on Broadway, with a lot of money on the line, you know, a lot of these shows like Wicked and Phantom and The Lion King, they have been living on foreign tourists for years. And when do foreign tourists come back? When will we let
That's
them
true.
In? We have a ban on people coming in from India now, right?
Right.
You know, what happens if you've got the spike in the virus in South America? Phantom of the Opera sells a lot of tickets to people from Brazil and Argentina. You have spikes in the virus there. They don't let people from South America in. Who's your audience going to be for the Phantom of the Opera? These are questions that we don't have the answers to yet.
And before I bring Eddie in, because that's a good point to bring in the future of Broadway, but I have one big question that I find, as a columnist who writes about gossip and who has friends in the business, and I write things that there's always that line between what I know and what I can say, because you don't want to burn your bridges. You don't want to piss people off. And I have heard more often than not the phrase "that fucking Riedel," but it's always also been followed with, "And he's right. And how did he know?" And so does that affect your relationships? Are there things that you know that you can't even tell people?
Yes. I mean, I was always pretty good about what was on the record and off the record with my friends and my sources in the business. But I never really held back. If I had a good story about a show, I mean, you know, my job was to get the story. That's what it was. I never really got into people's personal lives. That was a line that I decided not to cross. You know, I was not the National Enquirer. So I could write about the backstage bad behavior and fights and lawsuits and shows falling apart and all that kind of stuff. I never really got into people's private lives or their sexual lives. And really in my books, I don't either. That's just a lot.
Your books are totally different. Your books are not gossip. I mean, they're really insightful, but they don't have the gossipy tone that your columns had. But you cannot deny that you had the power to shut down a show or to kill a show or to make a show, conversely.
Well, I never had that kind of power that you have at the New York Times. The power that I had, once I realized I had it, I had a jolly old time wielding it. The power that I realized I had was I could stamp the perception of a show, right? Mm-hmm. So I could tell you early on, this thing is going to be a hit or it's in trouble. And then I realized that, you know, powerful people like Ben Brantley, he was then the drama critic for the New York Times when I was at mm-hmm. the height of my fame as a columnist. Ben Brantley would have to respond to what I'd been writing about. Before he even got a chance to weigh in on, let's say, Bernadette Peters and Gypsy, right? Ben Brantley would have to take into account that I'd been saying, everyone thinks the show's a disaster, she's missing performances, it's a mess backstage. He would have to take into account everything that I'd been written. And then I realized—
because that is perception already out in the world.
I could stamp the perception of the show. I mean, if I saw mm-hmm. something early on that I liked, like The Lion King or Hairspray, two shows I loved, I was there, you know, waving the flag saying, get your tickets now. This is going to be the biggest thing of all time. But if I didn't like it, like Spider-Man, I could say, you know, Julie Taymor, she's going to eat her little producer for breakfast and spit him out for lunch.
And you know, and that actually brings up a really good point, which was Julie Taymor, from what I've read, was a really close friend of yours and really was not so thrilled, unless this has changed over the past few months, with how she's portrayed in the new book. Did that affect your relationship?
Well, it was funny because Julie, I can't say.
And I think she comes off great in your book, by
yeah.
the way.
Well, I can't pretend I've been a great friend of Julie Taymor's, but I was a very big champion of The Lion King early on.
Oh, and it's so Julie, obvious.
Right. And so, you know, I got to know her through that and I've always admired her work. And so, yeah, we were friendly, I guess you could say. But then Spider-Man came along and then I had to kind of, you know, write what I knew what was going on. So there was a chill in the air and she didn't talk to me for a long time. But then I went back and I got in touch with her and I said, look, I'm writing a book about Broadway in the 90s and I got to write about The Lion King. I mean, The Lion King was the most successful Broadway show of all time. All right. The worldwide right. gross before the pandemic was $9 billion, billion with a B. So I said, I want to write the story about The Lion King because there was no sense that The Lion King was going to be what it is today. I mean, Michael Eisner, as I tell in Singular Sensation, the book, he almost pulled the plug on me. He almost said, yeah. you know.
That whole sequence of that private rehearsal for him and how it changed the trajectory of American theater to come is, I mean, again, I cannot stress to people the stories in this book that you think, oh, that's a nice little story. That's a story that ripples for the next 100 years.
Absolutely. Well, so Julie agreed to talk to me. We had a great interview. I think I was with her almost 2 hours. It was a lot of fun. And I do feel that I treat her very well in the book. But what happened
as
was,
do I.
So Vanity Fair excerpted the Lion King chapter before the book came out in the fall. And they, you know, they had these annoying people called fact checkers. I can't stand
them. Oh, that. Hate them.
They yeah. always get in the way of a good story. Anyway.
Thank you.
So the fact checker called Julie, and I had this, and I got to be honest with you, Billy. I mean, I'd heard this from, I don't know, maybe, I can't remember who told me, somebody I interviewed. And I said, look, everybody was having a meltdown out in Minneapolis with The Lion King. We were under such stress. You know, we couldn't run the show. The technical rehearsals were a nightmare. Everybody had a meltdown. And, you know, one day Julie had her meltdown and she locked herself in the ladies' room of the theater. And her assistant was able to coax her out. And that was it. I said, you know, even Tamar, I said, had her meltdown. Well, Julie, she read the phrase meltdown, the word meltdown. Mm. She thought it was sexist. I would never say that a man had a meltdown.
Oh, sure you would.
Of course I would. Absolutely. I mean, Garth Drabinski, his entire life is a meltdown in my
book. That chapter is, he's a psychopath, but we can't talk about him. Anyway, continue with Julie.
But so Julie was, she was screaming. She called me in the middle of the night yelling and screaming and betrayed her in this sexist, horrible way. I said, Julie, have you read the entire thing? I only heard about the meltdown.
Yeah, one quote, right.
Yeah, I can't talk to you. I mean, read the frickin' book, okay? And read the and you'll be all right. So far, I haven't heard from her, so maybe she's still having a meltdown over the fact that I'm
Julie, get over it if you're watching, because, you know, they all watch. So I am going to add Eddie Shapiro.
If she thinks, if she's mad at me now, right?
Yeah. Oh, the new book.
Wait till the next book when I talk about Spider-Man. Then she's really going to be mad.
She has people falling from rafters in that book. Oh, that's not a good book.
But she's a very good person, and she's a brilliantly talented.
And amazingly talented. And, you know, lighten up, Julie. We all have bad days. So Eddie Shapiro has written two books. He has written Nothing Like a Dame, which is Conversations with Great Ladies from Musical Theater, and A Wonderful Guy, which is the same thing, but about guys. So his books are amazing because they're really... you're hearing more from the subjects. And so I think it's really interesting that Michael is really more like a reporter, where Eddie, in his case, is interviewing and seeing what they want to say. So I want to welcome Eddie Shapiro. Hey, Eddie, I'm going to put you in the middle since you're new here.
Oh, that's so sweet of you. Thank you.
You know, I would say you're having a three-way, but he's engaged, so forget it. Yes, Eddie. So I really like what Michael was talking about where Broadway is going. And you had a really interesting conversation yesterday. Well, it aired yesterday on Playbill with Norm Lewis and Raul Esparza. And they talked about something that I know Michael has been talking about in interviews, about prices of Broadway shows being so out of control. And that maybe when we come back from this, that's going to be a leveler and things will get to a point where an average person could have in fact, bring a family to see a show like they used to in the old days. What do you think about that?
I think that so many things, right? We would love to see Broadway be accessible and affordable. And also, as Michael talked about at the beginning of this interview, it's all real estate. And the power lies where the buildings lie. And New York City real estate costs what it costs, and the unions are what they are. Michael also talks about in the intro of his book how genius he thought it was that Scott Rudin slashed prices in order to fill seats when the pandemic started, proving that some of these producers are willing to take what they can get if it's going to fill the house. And maybe there's a lesson there in terms of the future and accessibility and maybe a little bit less greed. There is room for it, for filling a theater to capacity if you charge less. There are so many economic considerations. There are so many things that, you know, my mother was even saying to me today that, she like everyone of her generation remembers a time when you all just went away.
I just wanted to let you speak.
Gotcha. I got scared for a second that I was suddenly speaking to my walls, which I frequently do. She was saying that, you know, she remembers a time when theater was really for everybody, and she is a student in Brooklyn would go and could do that. And what student in Brooklyn is now spending $150 on the theater? So yeah, these are all existential questions that Broadway has to face, as it also faces questions of diversity. It's not just ethnic diversity; it is also economic diversity that is a real issue for its future.
Michael, what do you think about where Broadway goes after this pandemic and how it has the opportunity to reinvent itself as family friendly, economically friendly people, rather than something that is just for the select few who can mortgage their house to get a ticket to see Hamilton?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, look, Broadway is not, it's not the nonprofit world, okay? So these guys,
right,
they take big risks. Huge risks, and I never begrudge them making all that money. But even I, as someone who's a capitalist Republican, even I looked at those ticket prices for things like Hamilton and thought, my God, how much longer can this go on? And you know, the answer was, before the pandemic, sky was the limit. There were a lot of rich people out there who were willing to pay those prices to see those shows. I think if I were a producer coming back with Broadway, I would come, because I know that the first people coming back are going to be New Yorkers, all right? And New Yorkers
Right.
I've seen the Phantom of the Opera. It's been around for 40 freaking years. All right. So not news that the Phantom of the Opera is reopening on Broadway. If I were a producer, I would find the new Edward Albee. I would find the new August Wilson. I would find the new Wendy Wasserstein. I would want to open up with a really interesting, exciting new play that is going to entice New Yorkers back at a reasonable price. And I think that's where you begin to build the theater back up again. You can't just open up and think the tourists are all going to be here and the Lion King will keep on roaring and Wicked will go on forever. You know, that's a boring Broadway. I want to see some more adventurous work being done. And I think now is the time to take the risk.
But you say
Eddie,
that,
you disagree?
And while I thoroughly agree with the philosophy of it, we all know that even the best reviewed straight plays on Broadway don't last much more than a season, if that. You know, August their season.
But is there something wrong with that? I mean, I had mentioned earlier that we would have the new play that would last 8 months and was a success and made way for the next new play. Is that bad?
No, it's not bad, but how rare is it? Unless you are Scott Rudin and producing with star casting, doing Three Tall Women with Glenda Jackson and Laurie Metcalf, you're not going to make your money back in 8 months, even with the three-person cast.
It's going to be a factor. I mean, I wish Scott had refrained from throwing baked potatoes at people because he was the generator of straight plays on Broadway. I mean,
absolutely.
But I do think, though, a good play like August Osage County, and that made people a lot of money, even though, okay, it ran maybe a year and a half on Broadway, but that's enough for a play. And then you have
and it also had life on the road.
It's done everywhere. I mean, it gets done all over the place, right? August Osage County. So August Osage County was a successful show without a star. I hope, because I love plays, I hope that we still have a theater world here in New York, where a great play written by someone we've never heard of before, because of the quality of the writing and the quality of the acting and the direction and the production, I hope it can hit. I hope we are not just going to be reopened and pray the tourists come back. Because if that's it, then that's a Broadway I'm not that interested in.
Well, although the first two shows that have been announced and have given their dates are Six and Phantom of the Opera. So, I mean, so much for the idea that a straight play is going to what?
No, Passover has been announced. And
that's true. It has. You're right.
That's in the right direction. But I mentioned August Osage County as an anomaly. I mean, that play is the only one that I can think of until To Kill a Mockingbird. That's a play that has run for multi-season.
Great plays are rare. You know, I mean, look at the 20th century. There were four great playwrights. Okay. Eugene O'Neill, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, and Edward Albee. There are only four.
And your chapter about Edward Albee not being able to get anyone to even read a later play is fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Edward, whom I knew very, very well, you know, and as I detail in the book, Singular Sensation, Edward was down and out for the count. Nobody would. He had nothing but flops on Broadway. And in the 80s, nobody would look at an Edward Albee play. He was out of fashion or out of vogue as Myra Carter, the actress who was in 312 Women, she said, Edward Albee, he's out of vogue. He's not in vogue anymore. Mm. And, you know, Edward, and I knew him when he was out of vogue. I knew Edward when, you know, I could meet him at a diner, right? Because he couldn't get a table at Joe Allen. And he handed me
a play. The humanity.
He handed me a play one day. He said, and Edward is a very, very serious person. Would you like to read a play I've written? I said, well, sure, Mr. Albee, I'd love to. Here. And he pulled out of a satchel this play called Three Tall Women. And I went home and I read it. And I called him. I said, Edward, I just finished Three Tall Women. And he said, and? I said, I had the same feeling when I finished Three Tall Women as I had the very first time I read Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And he said, that's nice to hear. Unfortunately, nobody is interested. Couldn't get the play here in New York. It was done in Vienna first. Then he did it up in Westchester.
Right.
Got it at the Vineyard Theater. And, of course, it became a big, big hit off Broadway. Won him a Pulitzer Prize and gave him one of the great second acts in the history of the American theater.
Well, I think that brings up the point that Eddie was saying, is that can we find those Albees, and do they even have the fighting chance to be seen and get to the attention of a producer aside from Scott Rudin?
Well, you can't get it. Scott's attention now unless you're a big there you go. So.
But that's or you can because he's got nothing but time on his hands. But anyway, it's very interesting to see how much look, theater has always been about business and selling, even though it is selling art. But it's still selling in business, and it will be really interesting to see how much producers are willing to make way for art in the coming months and years.
But Eddie, I think the only reason the theater survives is because of the artists. I mean, as I pointed out in Razzle Dazzle, you know, Bernie Jacobs was a lawyer running the Schubert Organization, but he backed Michael Bennett. Michael Bennett came up with a chorus line. If you don't back those guys, you got nothing.
I don't think that's true. I mean, I agree with certainly with your examples, but you can't tell me that Mamma Mia it ran because of its artistic merits, or for that matter, Moulin Rouge, which is stunning, stunning, stunning to look at, but it is a Vegas show. It's not the writing. It's beautifully designed, but it's not the creativity in Moulin Rouge that's selling it. So I think,
but like Anita Morris in Nine, you can come out whistling the costumes,
but Nine is awesome.
Nine is a good show. I don't want anyone to think that's all it had.
I don't really make much of a case for Moulin Rouge. And I think, as that would have played out, it may not have been the biggest hit that it was made out to be. I will make the case though, for Mamma Mia, because you have to remember not everything that we see on Broadway has to be just about art. It also has to be entertaining. And Mamma Mia was a very cheeky, fun, sly, entertaining little show. And as I will be writing in my third book, because I know Judy Kramer believed it. Judy Kramer, wonderful woman, by the way. Judy Kramer was completely broke, okay? She had been ABBA's, Benny and Bjorn's assistant, PA, they call them, a production assistant on Chess. That's how she got to know them. And she was, you know, jobbing producer at the BBC, and she was really kind of hard up, and she just wanted to do a fun little show using the music of ABBA, because that's the stuff that she grew up on. That's what she loved, and she knew Ben was born. But they had done Chess, which was such a fiasco on Broadway. They thought, we don't want to have anything to do with theater. We hate the theater. Theater's the worst place to go. And Judy just begged and begged and pleaded, and finally they said, okay, because we like you, Judy. You're our old PA. You can use our little songs and your stupid little show, okay? It was never conceived of as a mega musical. It was Judy Kramer thinking, I'm going to have this cute little show, cheeky little kind of quality. It's going to be kind of fun. She said to me, if it runs a year in the West End, I can get out of debt. And maybe it'll have a tour in England. And then maybe I can get my apartment back. All right, well, turned out to be one of the most successful shows of all time. And Judy Kramer is now the third richest woman in England after the Queen and J.K. Rowling. But she never set out to do this big blockbuster musical. For her, it was like, I just want to do a fun show, a little show
That's a lovely story, but not germane in the greater sense in terms of what we're talking about, art versus commerce. That when Mamma Mia took over the Winter Garden Theater, nobody was thinking of it as a little show that was going to run a year. They were thinking about it as a blockbuster they were going to make bank on for a very long time and send on international tours. And that is, by and large, the Wickeds, the Mamma Mias, and I'm not knocking Wicked or Mamma Mia for that matter. I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, when you talk about the artists being the thing, and then you just tell this Mamma Mia story. Yes, of course, entertainment needs to exist on Broadway and fun needs to exist on Broadway, but it's not just about finding the Albies of the world. Because if it was, then Judy Kramer would never have had Mamma Mia.
But let me just bring up a point, because Eddie, I know you're a huge Disney fan. Your first book was about Disney. And we have what Michael has talked about in his book, Lion King, changing theater. But before that, we had Beauty and the Beast, which maybe would have been lucky to be in a theme park, but somehow ended up on Broadway. I'm sorry to say, I love Talking Dishes as much as anyone. But I don't think anyone looked at Beauty and the Beast and thinking it was great art, but somehow Lion King did transcend that idea of theme park and actually became a theatrical event and a game changer.
Well, because of course, Lion King, as we all know, was reconceived as a theatrical piece as opposed just sort of putting the movie on the screen. And Beauty and the Beast does have the pedigree of the Ashman and Macon score, theater roots. So it really did sing like a musical. I think, you know, when we get into generalizing about any of it, Mamma Mia, Beauty and the Beast, Edward Albee, we're into a little bit of trouble because, as you said, Billy, and I think that you said it really about the business in general, but I think it's true of the art too. It really is the Wild West, because I've had arguments with people about, you know, the flip side of this, that shows have to be star vehicles in order to survive, or known entities like a Moulin Rouge. But then you can say, but then there's Come From Away, or there's Dear Evan Hansen, or there's The Band's Visit, which granted not the same level of hit, but these things that sort of come out of nowhere and make it against all odds and surprise everybody. And Broadway blessedly does have room for that, and thank God for it.
I mean, I'm happy that it's the Wild Wild West. I mean, I want all of those kind of things.
Yeah.
I want to see Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly. We know it's going to be beautifully done. We know she's going to be, well, I mean, yeah, it was kind of like Hello, Bette, as opposed to Hello, Dolly. But
that's okay.
Well, you kind of knew that's what it was going to be.
Well, no, it was a Bette Midler concert, and Hello, Dolly happened to be going on around her. But that's okay. It was entertaining and fun. But at the same time, then Come From Away, a total surprise. So I don't have a problem with it being the Wild Wild West. I think the more stuff we throw out there, the better. And let's have Glenda Jackson in Three Tall Women. Let's find the new August Osage County. Let's find that little musical Come From Away. And let's have Bette Midler doing a concert that MAME happens to be going around her at one point.
I want to see it all. I want to see all of it.
That's the thing about Broadway.
Yeah. Does Off-Broadway still hold that place where experiments can happen and it can feed Broadway, or no?
No. Everybody wants to be on Broadway right now. I mean, you can't make any money Off-Broadway. All the commercial Off-Broadway theaters that I was going to in the 80s and the 90s, remember the Promenade and the Hotel and all those are all, they're all gone now. The nonprofits took that over. And then the nonprofits, who, by the way, are as greedy as the for-profit people, don't kid yourselves. They all want to be on Broadway, too, because they all want to win their Tony Awards. And they, these nonprofit theaters, they want to charge as much as a Hamilton ticket is for you to go to see their shows. So now the whole Off-Broadway movement that I saw when I was going to college here in New York in the 1980s, that world was gone, totally gone.
That's true. That Off-Broadway doesn't exist anymore, but there's a different Off-Broadway that is the out-of-town tryout is now the Off-Broadway tryout for so many shows. And there are things that develop there successfully, and there's some good work happening. Although, yeah, I'm right there with you. I miss things that were devised to live Off-Broadway, only Off-Broadway, and that's all they aspired to be.
Look, I mean, when Three Tall Women was a success at the Vineyard Theater, a nonprofit theater, they wanted to move it to Broadway, but Edward had been so scarred by Broadway, and he knew, you know, what had happened to his friend Tennessee Williams, who was just killed by the critics.
Yeah.
Edward said, he said, I'm not going to take this play to Broadway. I want it to be off Broadway because they're not going to do to me what they did to Tennessee. And that show ran for 2 years at the Promenade Theater. And, you know, sad to say, the Promenade Theater is no more. Those theaters are gone. They're gone.
Yeah. But a huge part of that Edward Albee Renaissance was on Broadway right after Three Tall Women, with the revival of Delicate Balance that Lincoln Center brought to Broadway. And so that's very much in, you know, they went hand in hand.
That Delicate Balance, I was, I got to tell you, Billy, my favorite chapter in my book, Singular Sensation, is really Who's Afraid of Edward Albee, because I love that.
Oh, it's so great.
I love that production of A Delicate Balance. I'm sure some of your viewers may have seen it. One of the greatest, greatest productions I've seen in my life. But as I show in the book, man, it was an ugly situation back then.
I had no idea that it was a battleground backstage.
And George Brizard hated each other.
Absolutely. And poor Rosemary in the middle of that.
Anybody surprised?
Well, the thing was, because I knew Elaine very, very well. Elaine once said to me, I used to take her out for dinner from time to time, squire around. She once said to me, kid, if you were 20 years older and I were 20 years younger, we'd be putting up the jam together. So,
well, there's an image I didn't need, but thank you.
Thanksgiving dinner.
Michael, I just found out you're straight. Now you give me that.
I know. I knew George too. George was a great guy. But here's the thing. Elaine is completely insane. All right. And it's all about Elaine. Everything that she does in rehearsal is about Elaine. And George is a pro. Okay. I know my lines. I know my blocking. And we are going to do it the same way every night. It's not going to change. So here's George getting ready to go out to do a delicate bounce. And then there's Elaine in her, you know, her pantyhose running out to the box office 10 minutes before the show goes on to make sure that the box office guys haven't stolen her house seats. So she can get them, so she can sell them to the broker, so she gets the money. So I mean, George was like having none of this crap. And one night, and Andre Bishop told me this, who had a Lincoln Center, who produced the play. One night, George had just had it with Elaine. And at the curtain call, the curtain comes down, the standing ovation, the curtain comes down. And George slugged her. He just hit her. He hit her. And then Elaine went back to her dressing room. She got out her curling iron and she was chasing him around trying to hit him.
I'll tell you, you remind me of two Elaine stories. One is in A Wonderful Guy, Michael Rupert talks about having done the full Monty with her at Paper Mill. And he said that, he told me at the time at the opening night party, so this is, you know, they're still in the run. And he says to me, there is one person in the entirety of my career who I will never, ever work with again. And that is Elaine Stritch. He said, we didn't even get to run the show until today because she sucked all the air out of the rehearsal room all the time. But I'm reminded of another story, Michael, because you referenced how cheap she was notoriously. And Billy, I've never told you this story. Right after, you know, after I had interviewed her and after we talked for my book and we spent some time, she called me up and she asked me to do some research. She said, "Eddie, you know, you're so good at knowing everything I did. Can you sort of put it all together for me?" And just, you know, she wants her own resume created. So, Elaine Stritch asked a favor. Sure. Okay, I can do that. And she... which I did. And then she asked me to do some more stuff. And she said, "You're so sweet. I'm going to send you a couple of cases of Bay's English muffins," which of course, I'm still waiting for my goddamn muffins.
We're talking about.
I can top that one. So.
You got the muffins.
So I invite, because Bay's English muffins she sent because she was married to John Bay, who was the heir to the Bay's English muffin for. So one day I invite Elaine to, I said, "Elaine, come down and have dinner with me in the West Village where I live at a very nice restaurant right across the street from me called Perry Street." And she says, "Okay, well, let's meet at 7 o'clock, I guess. It was a beautiful spring day. And I come out of the building and I see Elaine walking down my street, trailed by every homosexual in the village. Because here's the thing, Elaine walked.
She is the Pied Piper.
But she walked everywhere. She was living at the Carlisle Hotel, but she walked down from the Upper East Side to the West Village because that was her exercise. And along the way, she collected all the guys who love company, right? You know, and there 10 guys are following her down my street. And she's telling them stories about when she was in company, when she did the Follies concert, and talking about Steve. Ah. And these guys like, they're like little puppy dogs behind Elaine Stritch.
But I'm hanging on her every word.
But I invited her, not 10 of her best friends, to dinner. So we go to the restaurant, and all these guys are around her. And then she turns to them and she says, "Boys, the play is over." Then we go and we sit and we have dinner. And she orders, I'll never forget this as long as I live. She orders the spring pea soup and the poached lobster salad. Now, this is not a cheap restaurant. This is a Jordan.
And you were paying.
And I was expensing it, frankly, but yeah. That's fine. It's fine. She says to the little waitress, she says, "I want the spring pea soup and I want the poached lobster salad." And she said, "And I want a double order." Said, "Excuse me?" She said, "You know, I'm diabetic. So if I have an attack in the middle of the night, I may have something in the refrigerator." So, I mean, you know, I took her out, but she ordered double, and I put
for the week.
I put the thing in, and my editor at the Post said, "Jesus Christ! I mean, this is like a $500 meal you took Elaine Stritch." I said, she ordered everything twice because she's diabetic. An attack. And they said, well, she's a Lane Stritch. So they signed off. I got away with it.
Thank God you didn't charge them for the jam. So, you know, we're talking about expenses and money. And one of the things that people talk to me about constantly is why can't people bring ticket prices down to a reasonable amount? And one of the reasons I always see, and I don't find a way around this, is that ticket brokers are going to gobble those up, and it's going to, the excess is going to go into their hands. And wouldn't I rather it went into the producer's hands?
That's only true of a Hamilton.
Okay, go ahead.
Only true of something that's
really
demand. Yeah, because when Diana the Musical opens on Broadway, for example, tickets are still $150, $160, $170 bucks, and the brokers aren't the people who are gobbling those up because there's no resale value.
Yeah, but I have tourist friends who have come into New York and they think that night, like it's 1942, oh, I can just go up to the box office and get a ticket for Wicked tonight. And they can't, and they do have to go to brokers.
Wicked and that kind of show, where brokers are selling, you know, through brokers and hotel lobbies, may be an exception. But by and large, you know, what's I think more criminal is that producers now, you could go online to buy tickets the day the tickets go on sale and be willing to pay not premium prices, so you're still in the $200 range and you're in the rear or the sides because the huge block that producers are hoping to sell at premium prices to people either willing to pay it or to corporations. And then, of course, they get released or whittled down as the show is less
successful.
Exactly. Or business.
Michael, you talk about it in your book about the producers, for example, of really breaking that ceiling.
They started it.
Look, if you want to know the history of how tickets are priced on Broadway, read the first chapter of my book, Razzle Dazzle, because that tells you about all of the corruption of ticketing. You got to remember, guys, okay, so we're going back to the 30s, 40s, 50s here. Broadway prices for years were artificially low, all right? The top ticket price was for a chorus line when it was the hottest show in the world was, what, 15 bucks? Well, come on. Right. In the free market, when you only have 1,500 seats to sell a night, that ticket is worth a lot more than 1,500 bucks. And that's where the brokers come in. Now, how do the brokers get their tickets? Well, they get them from the guys back in the day. I don't want to cast aspersions on our friends today. They get them from the guys who own the theaters.
The producers, correct.
The office, who produce the show. And also, and let's not kid ourselves, they got it from a lot of the creators and the actors in the show.
So like house seats.
Access to house seats.
Well, right. Elaine Stritch in her pantyhose running down 46th.
Exactly. She wanted to sell house seats to the brokers. I mean, are you kidding me? My old friend Phil Smith, God rest his soul, he was the chairman of the board of the Schubert Organization, and he died of COVID, sadly. Phil told me that, you know, Mary Martin's husband had a very nice trade going on in her house seats to the brokers for South Pacific.
Wow.
I mean, that's how it was done, folks. So what happened?
And is that a carryover today, do you believe?
What happened was everybody on Broadway knew this was going on, and it became a huge scandal. I mean, it almost brought down the whole Schubert empire and Razzle Dazzle. There was a big Attorney General investigation. They were going to throw everybody on Broadway in jail, and they decided not to because they thought if we throw them all in jail, there's no Broadway, and Broadway's kind of key to the survival of New York City. So we have to give him a slap on a wrist and tell him not to do it. But it went on for a long time. But it was Rocco Landisman, who ran Drew Jansen Theaters and who was the lead producer of the producers, Mel Brooks's show. And Rocco was like, why am I charging only $200 for a show that everybody in the world wants to see when I know the $200 ticket is being bought by brokers that they're then flipping for $500 or $600? So Rocco raised the tickets for only two rows. It was only two rows, the best rows in the house. He raised the ticket price to $480. And there was a hue and cry. Everyone was outraged. Well, I got news for you.
And they sold.
They sold. And by the way, that premium price seating that used to be only two rows, that practically became the entire orchestra of Hamilton. And they sold. And as long as they sell, you're never going to bring the prices down.
But conversely, when Rent started doing their lottery, they were giving away the cheapest seats were the first two rows.
Forget it. But the thing about Rent.
But was that marketing or was that savvy, business savvy?
What was going on with Rent there? And this was you know, they wanted a younger crowd, right? Mm. So they did offer the $10 ticket, whatever it was. But the brokers were there. Half the people online were working for the brokers.
And so there's no way around it.
And the guys in the box office knew who the brokers guys were. So they would give the tickets to the guys online who worked for the brokers, and everybody got their cut. That's the welcome to the world, folks.
I know. Well, is there an answer then, Eddie? What do you think?
I think it's whack-a-mole. I think just, it is. It's whack-a-mole. I mean, so you have to keep doing different things. And the Hamilton lottery is an excellent example of, you know, they keep changing it up, but they insist on it everywhere that they go that, yes, we're aware that we're making billions and billions, but at least for two rows of our theater, we're going to do it at $10 a ticket for a Hamilton.
Ten people who are going to stand in line all night long will get into our big show.
Well, that, you know, there's no more standing in line, but still the idea, I mean, there's some level of, but it's true. I mean, greed is going to be greed. And also there are the realities of the business that, you know, Broadway unions, real estate, marketing, all of the expenses that are make it prohibitive, you know.
You know, I think my favorite story in Singular Sensation is about, because I know some of the ticket brokers who told me some stuff I put in the book. This is how they rigged the lottery, okay? So remember, you had to stand online for a Rent ticket. You have to sleep out all night to get the Rent ticket.
Sure.
And then they would have, you know, you take a number, your spot online, you were 1, 2, 3, 4. They'd be like, let's say just 20 people online. And then they'd make a big show of, okay, come back at 5 o'clock now. We're going to draw out of the hat. Four numbers, right? And you know, you're 8, you're in, you get to see Rent tonight. You're 12, you're in, you get to see Rent tonight. Here's how it worked, okay? So half the guys on the line were working for brokers and they were diggers. So the guy drawing the stuff out of the hat, he would be in touch with a broker and the broker would say, okay, my guys are 4, 8, 14, and 19, okay? So when they cut up the strips, when they would pick them out of the hat, they would take the strips for the diggers and they would put them in the refrigerator in the box office.
So that they were cold.
So when the guy put his hand in the hat, he'd feel the cold ones, pick it up. Oh, 4, 8, 12. And all those tickets went to the brokers. I mean, that's how they
rigged. Michael, you've disillusioned me yet again.
I find this depressing. Even if it's I find it depressing as hell.
But Michael, I know
it's very clever. It's a very clever way of doing it.
It's a little too clever. Michael, I could talk to you forever, but I know our time with you is up. Michael, thank you so much for being on the show. Will you come back? Because I have so many more questions for you.
Absolutely. I'll bring Elaine Fritch with me too.
Oh my God. Bring some jam. I'll bring the jam. It's fine.
If you get Elaine to come with you, tell her I'm waiting for my muffins.
I'll leave you with this. This was a line that Steve Sondheim gave me. Remember when Elaine was in Showboat?
Yes.
And she sang to the baby, Why I love you. Why? And so she's with a baby there. That the fact that Elaine Stritch would even be holding a baby, even though it wasn't just a doll, is hilarious. So she's holding this thing, which is supposed to be a baby. And then she's like, why do I love you? Why do you love me? And Steve Sondheim says, is she going to sing to that baby or eat it?
Michael, with a cannibal joke, I think we have come to the end of our time with you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. We'll see you again soon.
Take care.
Michael Riedel, thank you. Bye-bye. Oh, my God. Oh, Eddie. You know, I don't know if you're going to be able to top that unless Audra McDonald date the baby in Ragtime, which would be great if you knew that.
Yeah, Audra McDonald has the. There were two babies.
I know she. Well, she auctioned one of those babies off. Audra McDonald is selling babies on the black market. You heard it here first. Yeah, she's a horrible person. No, I love my Audra. I love your first book, Nothing Like a Dame, which, of course, you know, I adore. I was at the release party for that book, The second book, A Wonderful Guy, what I hate is that I had to read it as a PDF. I know a book is forthcoming, but it was delayed. It just came out, what, like 2 weeks ago?
No, it came out on the 3rd. So I guess that's a week ago.
All right,
a week. A binding delay. They had a binding issue, but boring.
Dietary needs and binding. It's terrible. Rice.
It is in stores now. And the launch.
Who's going to a store? Well, people go to stores, I guess.
People do go to stores. And on Amazon and where books are sold. And this time the launch party, I can't be.
Yeah, we get no party.
Pandemic going on. But like there, it's a bit of a bummer because this book, Wonderful Guy, like Michael's, it takes years. So when it finally happens, you're ready to sort of, raise a glass, which you do now these days by yourself in front of your Zoom.
I'll drink with you. It's fine.
There it is. But yes, it is out.
You know, what I loved about watching you with Norm and Raul on Playbill was that, it was so interesting because I know that you're friends with both of them. And Raul basically said that throughout the interview process and until the book came out, he worried that he had said too much because when you're friends with somebody, you just talk and you tell things. And Raul is very opinionated and can be somewhat loose-lipped at times.
Actually,
there's nothing in it that I think that he regrets, but he's certainly worried about it.
Yeah, no, you've got the wrong regrets in his you're projecting a bit. He wasn't worried about saying too much about other people. He's worried about how much of himself he revealed.
Well, that's what I meant. Saying too much about himself, correct?
Yeah, because he walked into this. It was actually really interesting because, as you say, I knew him in advance, and he agreed to do this interview for the book. And then this, in their long conversations. I mean, we really dig in, but he dodged me for a good long time, and I was like,
really?
Up? I couldn't figure out. We couldn't schedule it, and it was only until he and Norbert Leo Butt share a manager. And after I talked to Norbert, Norbert put in a word for me with Raul to say, it's okay. But when I sat down with him, he explained that he had there was a particular piece in the New York Times where he felt like he just hurt people. Not business associates, people in his life.
Where, right.
In telling his truth, he had hurt other people. And he was really gun-shy and worried about that. And then he proceeded in the time with me to be quite honest, or I assume anyway. I'm assuming he didn't make up stories and lie to me. But quite vulnerable and really let himself. It's one of my favorite interviews in the book because he really allowed himself to show his insecurity. And nothing slick about him. And I really appreciated that.
So if that's one of your favorites, what is one of your least favorites?
I don't know. I don't mind saying that out loud. Len Carreyrou was one of my least favorites. And not because
really
is not a delightful man. He's delightful and warm and drops F-bombs left and right. And he's got a throaty laugh, all of that. But as an interview subject, and I speak about this actually in the introduction, it's challenging because Len Carreyrou is not somebody who, at least in my experience of him, spends a lot of time reflecting on the past. So I say then you did Applause with Lauren Bacall. Yeah, that was great.
Can you give me more?
So maybe what were some of the things that made it great? Well, what was it like working with Bacall? Well, we had an affair. But it's a lot of that. And again, not because I found him withholding. I just didn't find it. He was just sort of like, he struck me as somebody who doesn't dwell in the past. He just kind of has his memory. That was great. I'm glad I did that. Oh, I'm so glad I worked with that person. What else do you want to know?
But I think that, what I like about both of your books is that you do draw people out in a variety of different ways. And one of the things I have found about doing this show, particularly with people who I'm friends with, and full disclosure, you are one of my best friends. So versus Michael, who I've never talked to before. And sometimes that's easier because you haven't heard the stories before. You don't know how they tell a story. You don't know if they're performing for you or if they're being real. So who was the most surprising of the subjects that you said, wow, I'm getting stuff that I never could have even imagined?
That always happens every time.
Really?
Yeah, every time.
Do you have to work differently to get it?
Yes. Not differently. For me, my preparation, and I think I probably told you this before, in social circles or whatever, but what I do, as you know, like you, I don't need to research to find out what these people have done in their careers. I've seen all the shows. I don't need to research their resumes. What I research is what they've said, because I'm very interested in finding out the stories that they've told, so that I am, if I hear a story that's been told again and again and again, I can either go around it or I can preemptively get there by saying, you've said ... so ... I mean, my favorite example, like Carol Channing is, from the first book, and I've said this before, that she tells the story of the first time she got an agent at William Morris. And you can see on YouTube, you can see her tell it to Johnny Carson, and then 20 years later, tell it to somebody else verbatim. So you want to be able to recognize the stuff that's like, oh, that's just a tape. That's just the thing that they pull out. So my prep work to your question was to try to recognize those things so I could avoid them. And then that gets them.
Was there anybody that you couldn't get to avoid it, that it was so ingrained with them, that's all they had to say about it?
No, I don't think so. I do think that Carol Channing gave me some lines that, were gems that she had in her bank, in her piggy bank. But still, I feel like it ends up being organic,
fresh,
and interesting. But there were others who would just sort of drop things that made me go, what now?
Give me an example of something that really surprised you. If you can.
Yeah, no, I can give you a few. One is a chapter that has yet to see the light of day, actually, for a whole host of reasons. But when I spoke to Christine Ebersole and I asked her about the night she won the Tony, she said, well, for 42nd Street, the second Tony, she said, that was the first one. She said, I was hemorrhaging that night and I needed an emergency hysterectomy, a week later. And I was like, what now? That kind of thing. But also,
and why do you think she would tell you this that she has never mentioned to somebody else?
Well, you're asking the impossible question, right? Because I don't know what it's like to sit across from me, and I don't know what hypnosis techniques I'm using to drive. but I can say that I have heard from people that I'm very easy to talk to. And
I have never found that to be true.
Well, there you go. So I've heard from other people that I'm very easy to talk to. And I've also heard it been said by some of these people, by many of these people, actually, that, Stritch actually said it to me. And I think I probably told you this story. Lance Stritch called me after our interviews were done to tell me another story, which I so appreciated. And she said, I got to tell you something, Eddie. I get so bored talking about the past all the time. The past. It's just boring to me. But you have such a genuine love and enthusiasm for this stuff that when I think of a story, I immediately wanted to tell you because I knew you'd get such pleasure out of it. And that was really, really meaningful and lovely. And Carol Channing said something also fascinating to me, as I was leaving her place the first time. She said, well, thank you so much for being so interested. And I said, interested? Carol, isn't everybody who speaks with you, aren't they all interested? And she said, well, no. And I thought, okay, so maybe some number of people who they talk to are on assignment or just in there to get
them. Right, and it's a job.
Right, exactly. And they're not showing up as I do, with an intimate knowledge of who these people, or at least what these people have done, and then a genuine curiosity about who mm-hmm. they are and what makes them tick. So maybe that's it. I don't know. I can't be as objective about
so it. So conversely, is there somebody, and again, I don't even want a name on this one because I think it would be horrible for you to give me a name, but feel free if you'd like. Right. You can tell me after the show. Is there somebody who you did your research, was all excited to, and walked away feeling disappointed or empty?
No, I never felt. Not
really?
One people left me feeling ever disappointed or empty, ever. Sometimes I think that I got less in the conversation than I did. And then I listen to it and I go, where was I? Because obviously there's more good stuff in here than I remembered in the moment. But sometimes you're having a conversation and you're thinking about things and it's an organic conversation and you're not necessarily wearing your writer's hat or your editor's hat and thinking, oh, that's the stuff. That's the thing that I want to.
You're just having a conversation.
Right. You're just having a natural conversation. So I was sometimes surprised that I would find out listening to the playback that, oh, it was actually better than I thought it was. But nobody left me feeling empty except Len Carew, which empty is but after I edited, I thought I have to go
Len
back.
Stop watching. What
I just had to go back. And I even told him, I warned him in advance, and I said, here are the things I'm going to be asking you about, because I felt like we didn't cover well enough. So I just wanted to, you know, maybe prime the well a little bit.
And he's looking at the questions. Okay, Eddie, here are my answers. No, yes, sometimes, exactly. Twice.
Exactly. I can't say. Even on second go round, I got much more. But that's okay. That's okay. Because again, it wasn't because I felt like he was being standoffish. I felt like that was organically him.
You know, you've got everybody in the books. And, you know, you've talked about, because I will now say one of the quotes that you always say, which is that there are people that somebody might expect to be in the book, Liza Minnelli, Hugh Jackman, people who their careers are not Broadway centric, that it is right. A byproduct of their career, perhaps a very successful and fulfilling byproduct, but their career is primarily in film or television or whatever. Is there somebody who is a bona fide Broadway star with it in their blood that is alive, that you want, that you haven't been able to get?
Yes, there are several.
Let's go.
I mean, on this new book, In a Wonderful Guide, the one I knew going in I wasn't going to get, and I don't mind if he's watching, and he's not, but if he were, the one I knew was just going to be a jerk was Nathan Lane. And guess who was a jerk? Nathan Lane. Because when I asked Nathan Lane about doing
it, he said no to me as well.
He didn't just say no, though. No is okay. And, you know, and yeah, I did my courtship rituals. I sent him cupcakes and I sent him flowers, which
did he you send him some Bay English muffins?
I did not, because I didn't have that case. But I sent him these, you know, things, and he chose to ignore them. Fine. You have no obligation, even though it would have been polite. But then this predates my sending him stuff. I saw him in person at Carnegie Hall. We were both at something. And on the way out of the theater, I said to him, I approached him and I said, I wrote this book, Nothing Like a Dame. Oh, did you? Yes, I did. And I'm doing a follow-up now, and it's on the men. And I'd be so honored if you would participate. No. Well, maybe I'll get a copy to your publicist of Nothing Like a Dame. You can peruse it, and perhaps you will feel differently after you take a look. No. I mean, just ripping with this.
And you still sent him cupcakes?
I did.
You never sent me nothing.
I find him interesting. We don't have to be besties. I find him interesting.
And it's an important career in the fiber of Broadway in the past 20, 30 years.
Right. And with certain, you know, having been in the numbers of rooms that he's in, where interesting things happen.
But perhaps you wouldn't have gotten anything out of him.
perhaps I wouldn't, but I only would have known by trying. And there were others who I wanted.
Who else?
Well, Brian Darcy James and Danny Burstein are both people I pursued and both passed because they're not really big on talking about themselves and looking back on themselves. And I got the same thing from Bernadette Peters that, you know, I was told if I was talking about dogs, she would talk to me for hours. But talking
to her about dogs. Ask her which show of hers the dog liked.
Right, exactly. I sent dog biscuits to try to lure her. I mean,
You sent the wrong kind, you
know,
I'm sure.
But and then of course there's the fantasy. There are the people who passed. You know, I mean, I'm so sorry to have missed, you know, Jerry Orbach. I'm so sorry to have missed.
And he would have done it.
But
John would have done it as well.
Well, thank you for that Ouija board.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, I know these things. And one of the chapters I loved in the first book was the Angela Lansbury chapter, because I would think she would be a difficult interview in a certain way. And yet she seemed very forthcoming to you in ways that I did not expect.
Me neither. But again, she was lovely and relaxed. And as I think I said in the introduction, I don't even remember now, but she was the one person who called me afterwards to thank me. And she insisted on making me tea. I mean, she couldn't have been, more lovely and relaxed. And that's the goal, right? To have them completely at ease, so that they're, and you know, it sounds like it's a manipulation, right? It sounds like to have them at ease so that I can get what I need from them. It's not that, although to some degree it is, but it is also, the idea is for them to, both books are to honor these people and to pay tribute. I'm not interested in getting gotcha moments or
what's wrong with
comfortable
you?
Enough to, you know, to sling hash or to sling, you know, mud at their peers or whatever, but it's just to get them feeling safe enough, to talk freely.
Was there a question you asked somebody that you knew was going to be shaky territory and you got a shaky response?
There are many questions I've asked that have been shaky territory.
But was there one that, like, you think to yourself, God, I can't ask this, but I have to ask this? I mean, what was the toughest question you asked on your subject?
It's always difficult going into talking about somebody's flops with them because flops are painful. You never know if what they're going to be able to talk about, even if you're praising somebody's performance and how well they did or how well they came off,
it's still a flop.
Well, and also that thing that they were in, they were invested, right? They poured their lifeblood into that thing. So even though you can say, wow, that show sucked, I mean, you were great, but that sucked, that's not what they want to hear. They chose it. They chose that show. And even if they know the show was terrible, what they want to hear is that, you know, you got some pleasure from it. And obviously I'm generalizing, so that getting into a comfort zone when we're talking about something that wasn't good. And also sometimes the excuses people give for something not succeeding, like, oh, well, you know, Hamilton got all the attention that year. Yeah. Hamilton got a lot of attention that year. That is not the reason your show
still was crappy. No. Well, have you challenged those opinions with people? And was there somebody who refused to back down from their opinion?
That's an interesting question.
You know, give you an example. Is you have a great chapter in this book, Nothing Like a Dame. One of several copies I have in my numerous homes. Good. It's you know, both of these books are great reference books because you can read a chapter about Patti LuPone, for instance. So when you read Patti LuPone's autobiography, what's fascinating about it is that it is a lineage of failed shows. There is a point after Evita where everything bombed, and there's the Chicago fiasco, and there's just so much stuff. And her opinion, and the way she presents it in her book is very different than in your book, where she's discussing it and really being questioned in a way that maybe she would not want to phrase it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And
it also helps that you're spending the weekend with her and she's baking you bread.
Yes, that helped. But also, I think that, Donna McKechnie gave me a great compliment. She called me after she read her chapter and she said, "You captured me better than I captured me." And I feel that strongly. You know, I'm doing a new book on the ladies, and the Barbara Cook chapter will finally run in that. And I actually love, I think Barbara Cook comes off better in my chapter than
in her own book.
And that is because there's self-censorship will get in your way.
And so objectivity will show you in a different light.
Right, right. So when you're writing your own story, and by the way, I think this would be true of me too. You're asking me questions and I'm answering you as frankly as I can. But if I were curating my own self, I would probably ask myself easier questions or questions that had answers that were a little shinier. When somebody else is doing the asking, then you're in a different position.
Is there something that you left on the table? I'm not even on the table, but that you really wanted to ask somebody and didn't.
I didn't tell you there'd be
a quiz, but
there are always gossip questions that I'm always curious about that I don't pursue.
Such as?
Like, for example, I knew that Patti LuPone, I should really stick to Wonderful Guy, but since I brought her name up, I knew that Patti LuPone, I knew that from people who were there, that there was a war going on backstage. And there was the Patti camp and the Linda Hart camp and At Anything Goes. And I could talk about difficulties backstage, and she could talk about when a backstage environment gets toxic,
but right, I which she does bring up.
She does, but I wasn't willing to go all the way to say, "I heard this story and this story," because putting her on the defensive isn't gonna help either one of us get through this process.
Unless it's at the end of the interview.
Yeah, but
let's talk, for instance, now I happen to know something that I probably shouldn't bring up, but bringing up Patti LuPone, Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown.
Yeah.
Now, there was a war going on there, and you did bring it up to Sherry Renee Scott.
Yes, I did.
So there was a situation. Now, that was also a war that did spill onto the stage and affect the product.
Yes.
So is that what made that different? Because you were willing to ask her about that, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, I was. And I am trying to see if I can pinpoint what made it different. And I think...
Well, I know we were talking about it the week before you talked to her, and I said, you have to ask her.
Yeah. Well, I think two things made it different. I think that Sherry Renee Scott was the center of a flop. And so I was asking about that and how that felt and how much responsibility she felt she bore. And then the Patti thing was a natural segue. And she talked about, you know, the relationships back there. So there was that piece of it. But I also think, or at least I hope, that since the time I wrote Nothing Like a Dame, to then Wonderful Guy, to now be working on the next volume of Women, I've gotten better. And I've grown some. So some things that I might not have navigated, perhaps I'm a little bit less, I don't want to say scared, but I think especially with Patti LuPone and people who were like, and Elaine Stritch, those were the two walking into to that book that I was a little bit afraid of having my head bitten off if I made a misstep. So I felt like I was... I cared more about eggshells in a way that doesn't make one the best journalist. I'm not saying in either case that I did those books a disservice, but or those chapters.
They're different.
but I feel like I was perhaps a little bit more careful just based on reputation.
On the other hand, Sherry Renee Scott didn't make any bread.
But Sherry Renee Scott, I mean, Sherry Renee Scott and that chapter, that woman, we spent 12 hours straight without, we got up to pee once, but 12 hours on, you know, and she's fascinating. She's fascinating. So that's a preview of things to come.
And when is that book supposed to be out?
I'm only halfway through it now. So it'll
be. I didn't ask that question. When is it coming out?
Well, it's amazing how much faster I was able to get work done when none of the actors are, in fact, working. And
yeah, people are just sitting home.
Yeah, scheduling became easier and I was home.
And you and I have talked about this, that in the past, you only would conduct these interviews in person. Right. And this being a whole new world, and also technology having caught up with all of us, you were able to do these via Zoom or whatever and open up people's schedule. People were available.
That's right. And it's not my favorite way. And now that, you know.
And does the interview suffer if you're not in person, do you think? What do you think now?
It's hard to say, right? Because there's no basis for comparison. On the one hand, I think there's something essential about being in the room with somebody and their comfort. And it also
you're very popular.
It helps me to also get context for them as opposed to being on camera. It's a different thing. But during the pandemic, do I think that the interviews that I did during the pandemic for this new book are any worse? No. But is that how I want to do it moving forward? No. So if now that I can be in person with people who are comfortable with that again, that will still be my preferred method, even though it's far, far easier to schedule with people who, you know, you're just scheduling a Zoom call.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that also there is a casualness to being in your own environment that isn't quite the same. Although you did go to these people's environments in many cases, but there's a formality of inviting somebody into your home versus on a webcam.
Right. That's right. That's right.
You know,
although it is, you know, it is fun sometimes. You want to talk about comfort, like Melissa Errico showing up in her pajamas. Good. I'm glad you feel comfortable enough to show up in your pajamas. That's good.
Right. And you know, I'm not wearing any pants.
Why would you?
Yeah, exactly. But I would have done that in person with you, so it doesn't matter.
And also, would you have been wearing pants had you not known that Michael Riedel was fianced?
Well, I didn't know about the jam. So had I known about the jam, all bets were off. Yeah, you and I will talk about that when this show is over. So I want to remind people, Eddie Shapiro's two books, Nothing Like a Dame and A Wonderful Guy, are available now. Get them at Amazon or at a bookstore if you dare go into one. And Michael Riedel's two books, Razzle Dazzle, The Battle for Broadway and Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway, although not exactly, but you know, it's kind of triumph. There is a triumph and there is Broadway, so I can't
there
really
will always quibble. Be ebb and flow. There will always be feast and famine.
Apparently there will be. All of these books are available on Amazon or wherever you get fine books or not so fine books. They are all available everywhere. Eddie, don't hang up, but I want to thank you for being on the show. We will talk off camera, so I'm just going to put you backstage, but thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
I'm delighted to be here again. Thank you so much for having me. And for
oh, that's right. We had you before for the first book with Levi. Was it Levi?
It was with Levi.
Yes. Oh, little Levi. He is gay, but he's married. So, you know, now what do you do with that? Get married, gay guy, fiance, straight guy. Anyway,
I do this.
Yeah, I know, exactly. All right, Eddie, thank you for being on Billy Masters Live. I appreciate him putting you backstage. Everybody else, thank you for watching Billy Masters Live, another fun show. Next week, there will be, I believe, a panel discussion. I cannot say who it's going to be, but it's going to be somewhat diverse. And if it goes the way I think it's going to go, but you can't really plan these things. It should be a lot of fun. And if it's not, you'll already be invested. Thank you for watching. Have a great weekend. Happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there. And just remember, if we're here, we're live. Bye, guys.